broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Very good morning, guys, and good morning from isolation yet again. I don't know if you're like me, but I can't even remember what day it is or what time it is.
Yeah, I've been feeling that way.
Hey, I've got to say, I'm feeling exactly the same way, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Yes, so you're still out. You're still working. I suppose we're all still working, but in the office is hard.
Yeah, well, getting into the office around about midnight every night and working through until around about 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning is, you know, at least watching the markets until then is quite taxing, but got to do what you got to do, hey?
Yeah, that's right.
And you guys in isolation, are you coping? It seems to get happy hours seems to be starting earlier and earlier for me.
Yeah, I think that's a common theme too.
Well, I think there's a bit of surprise at how quickly everyone seems to have adjusted to the new normal. This time last week, it was a bit of a sense of what the hell is going on and how do we cope with this? And then the middle of this week, I just felt like people were starting to get into a bit of a groove and like, okay, I can deal with this and I can push on. And it kind of stands as a testament to how adaptable people can be.
Does that mean we're gonna have some good numbers this week in terms of production? Does it amongst the team?
Look out for those KPIs. Well, at least they'll hopefully be coming off the floor.
I actually feel like I've had one of my most productive weeks of the year, probably because no travel time. I'm as soon as I wake up, I can be at the office and. And also no interruptions or minimal interruptions. So I feel like I've actually churned out more work than I normally would in a week.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you on that one, but it's almost exhausting the amount of phone calls that I think I've taken this week, just sort of dealing with all the things that have been going on. So, just right across businesses, it seems to be certainly keeping up with all the information.
I think there's a huge variation because, firstly, it obviously depends on your job. But secondly, it depends on your personality type. And for some people, they would love nothing better than staying home all day and being behind a screen all day and not talking to people all day. But for other people, they're going to feed off the energy of people around them. And now that they're in isolation, they're going stir crazy.
I must admit, I'm the latter, and not having social activity or being around people is not the best for me.
Yeah, it's tough. Isn't it?
It was kind of fun for the first couple of days, and now I'm like, well, wouldn't mind seeing someone.
Yeah, I'll hear you.
Yeah. Anyway, to kick things off this morning, actually, we might throw to Joel, because Joel, you're going to kick us off with talking about the stimulus package, which is pretty topical, and what the impact of that's going to have on the Australian federal government budget.
Yeah, so this is by far the largest fiscal and monetary stimulus package that has been announced in the Australian government history. It really dwarfs the global financial crisis. In fact, it's around about 5.5 times larger than the stimulus package that was announced during the GFC. So far to date, the government has announced three separate measures or three packages. They're totaling around about $213.7 billion so far in announced packages. That represents around about 16% of GDP, which is, by the time you add that to the Reserve Bank stimulus, it's around about 16% of GDP, which is absolutely enormous. So the first package was the $17.6 billion that was announced on the 12th of March. That was the one that addressed the Centrelink benefits and those out of work payments. The second package was the one that addressed the small business tax relief, and also and that really targeted a lot of the small business PAYG relief that was coming through. And then the third package, so that was around, that was $66.1 billion. That was announced on the 22nd of March. And then about a week after that, we've had our third package, which is the JobKeeper package, which is about $130 billion. So all up in terms of fiscal stimulus, that works out to be about $214 billion worth of stimulus across those three packages. Now, as a result of these packages, we're expecting that, and many economists are actually expecting that the stimulus is not finished there. In fact, it's estimated that that there will be probably all up somewhere around about $310 billion in additional in packages all up by the time this is all said and done. Now, the interesting thing is, though, that you would think that this is going to be a huge cost on the Australian federal government. And the reality is, though, because interest rates have come down so low, the Australian government is actually going to be in a position where they can refinance old debt that is coming to maturity in the next 12 months, to the point that there's around about $46 billion, and just bear with me for a moment here, there's about $43 billion worth of debt that's due to mature over the next 12 months. Some of that is currently attracting an interest rate, so about $18 billion of that is attracting an interest rate of 1.75%. And the other $26 billion tranche that's coming due, that's going to be refinanced, is attracting an interest rate of 5.75%.
Oh, wow.
Now, with the Reserve Bank trying to keep the three-year bond yield, government bond yield, down around 0.25% at the moment, by the time the Australian federal government refinances that $43 billion of debt over the next 12 months, with the $300-odd billion expected in total stimulus from the federal government, that's going to work out to be about $1.8 billion worth of additional interest per annum. But the savings that they're going to receive from refinancing that $43 billion worth of debt is expected to be around $1.5 billion worth of savings every year. So the net cost to the federal government for all of this new money is actually going to be not much more than about $300 million a year, which in the grand scheme of things, you would think
it's not that much.
It's not that much. It's not going to be a huge amount of burden or increased cost to the Australian federal government to service that debt.
Yeah.
Mm.
Do you think there will be increased taxes or anything that come off the back of this? So, Joel, they give out money, and then do you think there'll be a flow and effect later, at a later stage, where they try and garnish some of it back?
Well, there's already talk that the tax cuts for middle income earners and for companies that were announced in prior budgets will probably come under some sort of scrutiny in the years to come, and whether or not the full amount of those tax cuts that were proposed in prior budgets will actually come to fruition. It's really going to be a suck it and see thing, though, because it really depends on whether or not the Australian economy rebounds and how strongly it rebounds. Because the Australian economy was sort of just meandering along prior to this crisis. If for whatever reason this becomes quite a cleansing of the Australian economy, you see, you know, poor actors go out of business, fresh, new, recapitalised businesses come in, and the Australian economy kicks off and does quite well, then you might find that future taxes or future tax relief may still be possible. But I guess really it's going to be a suck it and see type of event. Now, I can also see that that the CBA and Westpac have also come up with some revised numbers around unemployment. Now, at the moment, the Australian unemployment rate currently sits at 5.2%, but we all know that that's going to increase pretty substantially in the next couple of months.
Oh, yeah.
So the CBA have announced just this week that they expect about another 580,000 jobs to be lost over the coming months to see the Australian unemployment rate tick up to 7.8%, and they're expecting a contraction in the Australian economy of 7.5% over the next 6 months. Westpac are expecting about 814,000 jobs to be lost, and that should see the unemployment rate peak at around about 11.1%.
Ouch.
Now, to put that into some perspective, it's not as significant as the Great Depression, but where the Great Depression saw an unemployment rate here in Australia of 19.75% in the early 30s, but it will be higher than the unemployment rate in the 1990s, which peaked at around about 10%.
Mm.
So what we have coming ahead of us is going to be, you know, the economic pain is going to get worse over the next couple of months. Where it actually, you know, peaks, we're not quite sure yet. But, you know, I guess if the Australian economy can sort of see the worst of it over the next two or three months, and the worst of the retrenchments happen over the next two or three months, and then we can start to see some relief with some of these lockdown measures, then perhaps we're looking at more of a V-shaped recovery in the Australian economy. But if it goes much beyond that, I think we run the risk that more businesses than the normal would, or more businesses than perhaps what's being anticipated, won't open up when the Australian economy starts to open up. And that could mean that rather than a V-shaped recovery, we're seeing something more like an L-shaped recovery, which is a much more elongated recovery.
Yeah. Well, they're starting to talk about measures to have this lockdown order in place for 6 months. And that's my worry with the whole thing. I really hope that they don't, you know, keep this the way it is.
Yeah, well,
there's various theories around that over the next 6 months. And my own theory is that there's going to be some kind of impact until there's a vaccine that becomes commercially available and the community is mostly vaccinated. I think the most likely forecast in my mind is that we'll have these lockdown laws come in, then they'll be lifted to a point, but then if cases tick up again, then they'll bring them in again, and then they'll lift them on again, and we'll sort of have these this wave of heavy measures and then lighter measures, heavy, light, until we get to that point of the population mostly being vaccinated.
That's sort of a damaging thing in itself, though, to sort of restart a business and then pull back again, particularly for retailers, that would really hurt.
Yeah, well, that's where some of these new announcements are really geared towards not only getting people through the downturn period of time, but enabling people to get back onto it to support that V-shaped recovery that Joel is talking about. So the really big announcements earlier this week was the JobKeeper reform package. If I can just jump in and sort of take over the segment from here.
Yeah, no, right.
The JobKeeper package means that people don't have to get sacked by their employer and then go on to Centrelink benefits. So the JobKeeper package means that an employee who's employed by a business that suffered a 30% reduction in their revenue can stay being an employee. The government will pay the employer $1,500 per fortnight for the employer to forward that money onto the employee. Now, $1,500 a fortnight is $39,000 per year. It's not going to cover most people's salaries, but it is more than what the job seeker Centrelink payment is. So firstly, if you stay with your employer, you get a higher amount of money than you would if you went on to Centrelink. And secondly, it means that that person is still connected with that business, so that when conditions change, all the employer does is ring up their employee and say, hey, it's time to get off the couch, come back to work, we're open again. And then the other part of that, which was announced just in the last couple of days, was around childcare centres and a similar thing with childcare arrangements, where the government has said, firstly, childcare is now free for the consumer. The government's going to pay for all of it. And secondly, even if you choose not to send your child to childcare through this period of time because you're afraid of the health concerns, you can still keep your place in childcare. So once again, as soon as this situation reverses, it's more like flicking a switch where the parent says, great, the kid's back in childcare, I'm back at my job, and we're back to normal. What they're avoiding with these measures is when people want to go back to work or are able to go back to work, they're avoiding people having to spend weeks and weeks finding a new job, and they're avoiding people having to find new childcare, which again can take weeks and weeks, or in some cases months, depending on places. So they're really gearing things up for that V-shaped recovery and trying to support it as best they can.
And just the thing with the JobKeeper announcement, though, if, what happens if you actually lose your job in the middle of, like, you're receiving the payments, and then your employer comes back and says, well, actually now we no longer need you at the business? Where do you go from that?
I'm not sure an employer, I guess it could happen. I thought that the employer would be reducing people's salaries where they had to, down to $39,000 a year, so that the employer doesn't have any out-of-pocket cost for keeping that employee on board. Now, there's going to be cases where $39,000 does not cover the employee's wage. But what I'm seeing with a lot of employers is they're saying, well, since you're not required here at work because there's nothing you can do because our shop is closed or our business is closed, yes, you're a permanent full-time employee, but we're going to reduce your number of days. We just have to down to 3 days a week, or in some cases, 1 day per week. And the employee doesn't really have too much choice about it. But I think the employee is only going to reduce the employer is only going to reduce the salary down to that $39,000 threshold, and keep the employee on board, so that it doesn't cost the employer anything. I don't think the employer would let people go. It would be the employee who then looks for work, and if they can find full-time work in this environment, then good on them, and they'll leave and they'll take up that new job.
The only instance that I could think of where that might happen, Steph, would probably be if the business was in such dire financial position that it actually had to shut its doors irrespective.
Which I don't think is out of the question, though, either with some businesses.
No, it's not out of the question. And I think in that instance, what would then happen is that you then apply for your Centrelink benefits.
Then you go to Centrelink and the amount's much lower. So you'd come off that $1,500 and then go to a much smaller amount?
You would. It is a lower amount. And if you were the employee in question, you'd be pissed about it. You would hope that your employer can keep their doors open, or the employer would do something to help all the people that they are supporting anyway. Maybe the employer can acknowledge, yes, we are going to go out of business, so we're gonna cut off our leases and we're gonna stop all of our fixed costs, but we can keep on board our employees even though they're not doing anything. If we stop paying our rent, cut off our insurance, and then we're just the shell of a business and we still have a small amount of payroll, and then let the employees go and find their next jobs.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Okay, welcome back, guys. We're now going to throw back over to Louis, and you're going to continue with this conversation on talking about the stimulus package and what this means for individuals.
Yeah, I do. Just opening it up with what Joel was saying and the position of the government debt, I read something that before the coronavirus crisis unfolded, the forward projections of the government's debt position was going to be a peak of $392 billion, which this article had said was 19.5% of GDP. This article is a week or two old, so it had said that as a result of the first and second stimulus packages, the net debt was now going to go up to $507 billion, which I imagine is now going to be approaching $600 billion. And that would take our net debt position to about 30% of GDP. And Steph, you were asking around, does the government need to take measures so that they can pay some of this money back? And on the one hand, yeah, the interest cost that the government has to pay on this debt is really low, but it's an interesting question. Does the government need to pay that money back? Well, I'm not sure it does. It certainly doesn't need to have a short-term ambition to pay that money back, because if you look at governments around the world, there's no rule around how much debt should we have or shouldn't we have. If you look at companies as an example, there's plenty of companies around the world where they always have a mixture of equity on their balance sheet and debt on their balance sheet, because they just see it as a good way to get an optimum amount of growth and future revenues if they have a certain amount of debt on their balance sheet. Not that it makes it an ideal company to invest in, because debt can have its own issues, but for a government that can borrow money at such low interest rates, to have debt at a level of 20 or 30% of GDP, compare that with places like the USA or Japan or Spain pre-crisis, their level of debt is around 70% of GDP or more. I know Japan is more than 100% of GDP in their total debt ratio. Joel, do you have anything to add on that?
No, other than I'm in agreement with you, Louis. Australia's debt to GDP ratio, while it's a lot higher than where it was prior to the global financial crisis, where we basically had no debt, in comparison to other countries around the world and other developed nations, we're actually very much still at the low end of that ratio.
Yeah, so I guess we're in an enviable position in this country where we can put together this kind of stimulus measure and be in a good position to. I've heard the feedback from Spain is that their government is hamstrung because they just can't do this level of spending. They don't have the money. They're already geared too highly. Now they're forced to spend this money on the healthcare sector, and it means there's not really much money left over for economic stimulus.
The other issue to think about when it comes to Australia, the United States, other sovereign nations that have their own central bank and own currency, which the Euro region doesn't, is that we have the ability to be able to monetize our debt. Now, what I mean by that is all central banks like the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, the Reserve Bank of Australia, the Bank of Japan, they all have the ability to print their own currency. Now, traditionally, that would be a bad thing for countries to do if they were, you know, on an island of their own and they were the only ones printing their own currency. But at the moment, currencies are valued against one another on relative terms. Mm. And countries around the world are printing their own currency and monetizing that debt. So that's one of the things that that sort of separates us from many of the European nations like Spain, where they don't have that flexibility because they're part of a joint currency union.
Yeah, and talk about a luxury of these stimulus measures. When we look at the JobKeeper payments and the fact that it's going to subsidise wages by the equivalent of $39,000 per year, one group of employees you never would have thought would have their wages subsidised by government, look at the footy clubs. Professional sports people, they're going to have the government pay $1,500 per fortnight of their wages. How good is that?
I did also hear, Louis, that if you were earning less than the JobKeeper amount, it doesn't matter. It just stays as that. So if you're earning more, it's actually just a bonus for you at the moment. So
yeah, correct.
Anyone that goes back after that wouldn't like it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. If you were a permanent part-time employee, working a couple of days a week, you've gone up to $39,000 a year. Fantastic.
It's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. And that's one of the things about stimulus measures in crisis, is that there's going to be loopholes. They can only use blunt kind of instruments that do have adverse consequences. But you just got to take it. So a lot of life at the moment is luck. Luck in terms of what industry you've got your job in, whether you're on the front line or in the back office, and whether you're part-time or full-time.
Yeah. Another quick question about the JobKeeper amount. It doesn't take into consideration your partner in the mix, does it? It doesn't matter whether your household income's at a certain amount, you can still have access to that JobKeeper payment?
That's correct. It's got nothing to do with Centrelink testing or Centrelink arrangements. It's all done through the employer. So the qualifier is whether the business qualifies, not whether you as an employee, there is that whether you as an employee qualify, but not with the standard Centrelink measures. It's only if you're permanent or if you're a casual with 12 months of service. That's all you need as an employee.
Yeah, right. Joel, just for you, just throwing back to you, just some closing remarks from your end on the market itself.
Yeah, so we're in this interesting phase. I guess Monday last week, which is about 9 trading days ago, we saw a real capitulation and a puking of stocks. I think it was like the worst.
Is that the technical term?
Yeah, that's the technical term. A puking, yeah. At the worst of it, we saw most markets were down around about 36 to 40% intraday from their prior peak about a month earlier. Right now, we've seen a recovery. We saw a very sharp recovery, in fact, late last week, early this week, from those lows. And we've just seen in the last few days, markets have started to roll over again. They had a really strong 20%, 25% rally off those lows. But it just shows you, if you have a look at a stock chart, you would have thought that a 20 to 25% rally from those lows would be, you know, quite a meaningful move. But the magnitude of the sell-off has been such that it really is more of a blip rather than a meaningful tradable rally. Anyway, what we tend to find is that when you see these waterfall declines, around about 70% of these waterfall declines that we've just gone through tend to go through a period of back and forth filling. And eventually, sometime within about 70% of them, within about 8 weeks of the first decline and the first low, will tend to come back down and trade near those lows, if not undercut those lows, within about 8 weeks of the first low. So we're about 2 weeks into this recovery phase. But what it suggests is that we're probably now starting to see the early signs of the market rolling back over again. Now, I don't expect the selling to be anywhere near as aggressive as what it was on the first leg down. And in fact, there's a good chance that we may not cut below those lows. And if we do cut below, it's usually not a very meaningful low. So we're getting close to the point where over the next sort of four, or maybe over the next week to 5 or 6 weeks, where we're looking for signs that more conviction buying is starting to come into the market. We're not seeing that right now, but this could actually be over the next 4 to 6 weeks a pretty appealing time for investors to start wading back into the market and being very selective. I certainly wouldn't recommend doing it right now, and I certainly wouldn't recommend doing it all in one big go. But just to be on your toes and being aware and starting to do your homework and looking for those stocks that have really strong balance sheets that can weather through this storm and come out in a really strong position at the end of this. So I think now's the time to really be drilling in. And we're doing a lot of work right now, screening, looking for that strength. And if we do find this market rolls over and continues to roll over like we've seen in the last couple of days, what you should find is that There'll be a number of stocks that don't decline in line with what the market is doing, and they're the ones that you should be looking at to start doing and drilling in and doing a lot of your research, because they're the ones that are showing strength in the face of weakness, and they more often than not tend to be the next leaders when the market starts its new recovery phase.
So just something to keep in mind.
At this stage, no. We're screening and we're not seeing a lot of stocks. We're seeing some stocks that are bucking the trend, but we're not seeing stocks that are forming well-defined bases, and that's going to take a few weeks for that to occur. So it's now the time to start saying, okay, which stocks are actually bucking the trend? But it's a bit too early to be picking them off at the moment and starting to enter into them.
You probably need that second market bottom to come in, because you'll see the overall broader market falling. You'll see those stronger businesses not really fall or fall by a lesser degree. In that waterfall decline, in that first big decline, it was probably just everything being sold en masse, and not a lot of data you could take out of that for specific stocks. Whereas if there is a second bottom, then you'll get some more stock-specific information on how well it holds up compared to the market.
I just wanted to ask a question too, though. When you compare the two markets, if you're looking, I mean, Joel, you look at the US and Australian. Are you seeing any differences in the trends there at the moment?
Not so much in terms of the trends of the Australian market in regards to the individual stocks. The same stocks in the Australian market are being hit just as badly as what's happening in the US stocks, and that is we're tending to find that although it's not a huge level of outperformance, we are tending to find that more of those technology, recurring revenue stream businesses, businesses that are more inclined to benefit from a health crisis like your healthcare stocks and your biotech stocks, they tend to be doing a little bit better than your old world industrial stocks like your commodities, financial services businesses, and your industrial type businesses. And that seems to be a common theme that's happening right now. But remember, this sell-off was also exacerbated by a major sell-off in the oil market. We saw oil fall from over $60 a barrel only a few weeks ago to get as low as $20 a barrel only about a week and a half ago. And that was actually the result of the Saudis and the Russians having a price war on oil right at the wrong time. So I believe that oil sell-off actually has exacerbated some of the declines. It was almost like a double whammy. And there's been some reports today that the Saudis and the Russians are in preliminary talks facilitated by Trump to perhaps take and remove some of that supply out of the oil market. So we're seeing basically the same stocks in both markets perform in line with one another. There's no real – the only reason why the Australian market is performing considerably worse than the US market at this point in time is because we have a lot more of those old world commodities, industrials, and financial services businesses making up our indexes, whereas the US tend to have a lot more of those technology and healthcare and biotech businesses in their index.
Interesting. Just back on that oil prices as well, Joel, if this sort of continues on, and I'm just thinking about the amounts of oil that are taken out for like even commercial flying, will that have an impact on the price of oil going forward?
Well, with oil right now, the oil market's in a real spot of bother. You've got demand for oil has fallen off a cliff because airlines aren't flying. In fact, this time last year in the United States, 2.5 million. There were 2.5 million travelers per day on U.S. flights. Just this week, that's fallen to a low of 130,000. So, you know, if you take that volume, you're down around about 90% to 95% in terms of air traffic volume. That's a huge amount of demand for oil and oil-based products coming off the market. At the same time, you've got a huge oversupply of oil because of a price war that was happening between the Saudis and the Russians right at the wrong time. So there's even talk that we might have negative oil prices, because right now you've got You've got barrels. You've got so much supply that's sitting in tankers and storage facilities all around the world, and there's more oil that's coming out of the ground at the
moment.
Want
to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund?
Yeah, the holding costs.
Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor.
Yeah, now just a very quick point.
Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Hey, welcome back, guys. Throwing over to Brett now. You're going to talk about the property data and tell us a little bit about what's going on in the market.
Yeah, well, as we sort of discussed last time, and I'd say most people are aware, the market is going to slow in terms of transaction volumes, and we're already starting to see the flow-on effect of that with listings down. The interesting thing I wanted to share today, though, was the data from March in terms of what it's actually telling us. I think we need to take a perspective on this to really interpret it. Funnily enough, the clearance rate across the country for the last weekend, so probably the last series of auctions we're going to see for a while, was actually very strong. In fact, Victoria showed a clearance rate above 80% for last weekend, which is quite staggering. If you looked at that as a standalone piece of data, you'd think, well, geez, that's a great outcome and the market's strong. Yeah. The interesting thing to put in perspective here, though, of that, the volume of transactions was just over 300, and of that, 1,008 were withdrawn.
Wow.
Okay. That's huge. So,
of course, the clearance rate is only based on what went to auction. So if you're saying, there was supposedly 1,400 odd properties scheduled for auction, only 300 went to auction and 80% of them sold, but there are 1,000 that were scheduled that were withdrawn and another 23 postponed.
So either those sellers absolutely had to sell or sellers that knew that they had buyers still lined up.
Yeah, so there was still enough people that saw enough reasons to actually, transact at the time. But like we discussed last week, and we sort of forecast that there will be a lot of people just withdraw from the market. And as you can see, 1,000 versus 300, what's that? 70-odd percent of the market just pulled out.
Have you seen any data on whether it's starting to affect prices, though, or not?
Well, it's going to take a while for us to really know, but I thought this was interesting because the CoreLogic data, which is generally considered the most accurate and comprehensive, it actually shows that for the month of March, the national average dwelling price grew across the country.
Right. Okay. So,
well, I guess we've got to look at it from the perspective of, firstly, the data, as I've always said, is a slightly flawed metric because you never get comparable weeks of stock. You know, you never know when good quality houses are selling versus inferior quality. So it's always a difficult metric to be able to compare. But I guess that they have a metric that just sells what was the median price or what was the average selling price around the nation. And every capital city in every state bar one actually was in positive territory for the month of March.
Who was in the negative?
Hobart.
Okay.
And only by 0.2%. So the national average was that dwelling values grew by 0.7% for the month. So that's strong. I would have to make the assumption, though, that the majority of that was probably the first 2 to 3 weeks' results. And potentially, as we just alluded to, the transaction volumes for the last week would be significantly down, but that doesn't mean that those ones that did go to market weren't a basket of properties that actually showed growth in value.
Do you think, though, those people that already had their eye on those properties and were already sort of, you know, circling for those ones in the market already, had been there? And I think the next month's going to be very interesting to see
I think this is just a nice bit of data to put out there, but I don't think it's really telling us the story. Like, if you looked at the clearance rate on its own, you'd be thinking, wow, that's impressive. But when you look deeper, you get another story. And I think that'll be the same with these dwelling increases. Yeah, if once we've got a bit more data over the coming months, I think we'll be able to look at it in a different perspective.
Yeah. So, Brett, your theory, though, is still that people are just going to sort of hold on to their properties throughout this and just get back into the market once things are sort of cleared.
Yeah, people that don't have to sell, I don't think they would be coming up with any valid reason to sell. And given that the banks have agreed to mortgage relief for 6 months or potentially more, I can't see too many people that are going to be forced sellers in this environment if that's the case. And obviously with the JobKeeper allowing them to continue to pay their bills and outgoings, I mean, $1,500 a week, if you're a family that's got two wage earners getting $1,500 a week between two people, that should be enough to sustain your outgoings if you don't have mortgage payments.
Mm. Yeah.
I think most people could live on that.
What do you think on the interest rates? Brett, can they get any lower?
Well, they can't in Australia because I believe the RBA has mandated that 0.25 is the bottom. But in terms of what the banks pass on and what they charge, I think we sort of touched on it that we haven't seen an interest rate available for a residential mortgage below 2% yet. And I think someone will do it, whether it's purely for marketing purposes or it's a business decision. I think it'll come sometime in the next couple of months.
I think you'll see it on a fixed rate loan, not a variable rate loan. Someone will come up with a 2-year special fixed rate offer, something to lock in their customer.
Yeah, I think it's going to have – someone will come up with a 1.9 something.
In saying that, is it – what's your advice on taking that loan that did come out as a fixed term? Would you be going over and doing that or not?
What's your advice? Providing the any other associated costs and changeovers and everything don't have a negative impact, absolutely. Cheaper money is always better. So wherever you can get cheaper money, I guess whoever is considering that probably needs to make sure that they're speaking to their broker or have a good enough understanding of the way these mortgages are structured so that they can make the decision themselves.
Yeah, you'll never see a variable rate lower, though. If you get a fixed rate offer like that, often when you're looking at a fixed rate, the question is, yeah, but might the variable rate come down and be cheaper? But not going to happen in this environment. Variable rate's already as low as it'll go. So when that fixed rate offer does come out, it's worth looking at.
Well, and as you say, Louis, if that was offered for anywhere 2 years or even, if it was more, I would be jumping at it if I had a mortgage.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a good opportunity.
Definitely.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch the data come out over the next couple of months.
I think the April stats will tell us a totally different story, so I can't wait to see those at the start of next month.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, we might finish up with our favourite segment for the day, a little bit of happiness and sparkiness for the Friday. You can't be serious, guys. Who wants to start? I know you've been itching with this because you've all got some interesting ones today.
All right, I'll kick off then. This could be an upside or a downside depending on how you look at it. But one of the things that we're starting to see flow through, certainly in China, and it's probably going to happen through the rest of the world, is divorce rates are spiking.
Wow.
Unfortunately, this isolation is causing too many couples to have to spend extended periods of time in each other's company. And it's leading to a lot of the issues they may have coming to the fore and resulting in a higher number of lodgements for divorce.
Joel, you'll have to keep trading at night time. It's a good thing for us.
a prominent UK lawyer said that peak times are usually during holidays when couples are spending more time together, and this is just forcing them to have to do so and bringing all the issues to the fore.
Just on that, though, I did hear a stat that it can have the opposite effect. And you either divorce or you become more loved up and there's more marriage proposals during this time. So
I'd like to see the breakdown by age.
Exactly.
That's wonderful, wonderful sentiment, Steph, but give us data.
We'll come back to that for next week.
Okay. Yeah. Sticking to the UK and what couples are going through over there, apparently in the UK there is now medical advice that you need to either shack up together or go to Splitsville. UK medical advice is saying, look, if you're in a relationship with someone but you're not living together, it's time to make a decision. So are you in or are you out? They don't want people going between two households. They want people to either become one household or stop it.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting, though, because I'm pretty sure we had a law like that you weren't meant to be visiting your partner either, and that has just been relaxed.
Yes, that was right. That was here in Melbourne and Victoria. New South Wales.
Bonking ban, they called it.
The bonking ban. Well, I think in times like this, where you start to see some of the conspiracy theories coming out about what actually led to coronavirus. There's one that I've been listening to last night that gets you thinking a little bit. There is a conspiracy theory that says that this is related to 5G.
So, 5G.
I always knew 5G was going to do it.
So apparently the theory is that 5G operates at a frequency which is not conducive to human tissue. And what happens is that our body is trying to reject the effects of these high frequencies that are coming in through our bodies. And it's responding by producing excretions from our orifices, such as mucus and various other, you know, issues that pop up that are similar to a virus. So if you're wondering where this coronavirus may have started, it may actually have something to do with 5G. And I just wonder, you know, if we are moving to a world now where video and video conferencing and is going to play a much larger part in our world. I guess we're sort of stuck in that position where you can't live with it and you can't live without it.
Joel, does that mean we're going to be in isolation forever?
Oh, jeez. Speaking of video conferencing, I've got another one on that. And going back almost a decade, the rise of smartphones led to a rise in the practice of photobombing, where someone would walk up behind a couple having a photo taken, and unbeknownst to them, you flash a finger behind them or stick your head in the photo. Well, today's practice, with all these meetings coming to video conferencing, now we have the practice of what's called Zoom bombing.
People
using the Zoom video conferencing platform are finding that people around the world are randomly typing in meeting IDs, and if you don't have password protection on your particular meeting, or even if you do and someone with a bit of technology is hacking the password, they'll find that there is some random person in on your Zoom meeting.
That's quite funny, actually. You don't have to laugh if that happens.
And this is the case to the point where there's actually been an FBI warning come out, saying that your Zoom meetings are not secure.
Wow. Ooh. That's so fascinating. Just the things that happen out of change of work.
Isn't it? So it's one thing to have someone randomly listen in or interrupt your presentation, but apparently these Zoom bombers are sometimes being a bit nasty and broadcasting porn on their screen right in the middle of a business meeting.
Actually, the ABC did an article on, yeah, exactly that, Zoom, the FBI warning about that security flaw.
Mm.
So,
look out for the Zoom bombers around if you are using Zoom. Well, look, guys, we might end it there for today. I wish you all the best in isolation, and I can't really say have a fabulous and exciting weekend because I'm pretty sure it's kind of like Groundhog Day and we're going to be doing the same thing, but at least everyone will have a clean house.
You reckon? Yeah, through that.
You do. Hope so.
That's right.
Well, have a happy Friday, and we'll see you again next week. Well, we won't see you. I'll speak to you again next week.
All right. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye, guys.